Lionel Fanthorpe with us this hour. We're going to talk about mysteries and secrets of voodoo, just one of the topics, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Lionel, one of your books, Mysteries and Secrets of Voodoo, Santeria, and Obeah. What are they?
Well, voodoo is a mixture of early Catholicism, you know, religious Catholicism, and the ancient African religions. And in the voodoo faith, there's only one God who created the universe. And subordinate to him are some lesser gods, some lesser deities or saints, who they call the Loas, that's L-O-A-S. And they act as messengers between a voodoo practitioner, a human being here on Earth, and God. And then finally, they have some priests who they call Hungans, and the priestesses are Mambos. So although some of the followers of the voodoo faith came from Africa, there's now maybe 50-50. They're all over the world, and maybe 75% of them are female. So the most important part of a voodoo religious ceremony is the way that they work themselves up to what they believe to be a spiritual and religious frenzy. You know, they all dance to very exciting voodoo music, and they'll drink. And sometimes when high-paying tourists come along to watch the ceremony, there'll be one or two other things that maybe we shouldn't discuss on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, exactly.
But eventually, some of the voodoo followers who are taking part in the ritual become possessed by the Loas. This is their belief. And they are then said to be riding a horse. The human being who has been possessed is the horse for the Loa, who is the voodoo demigod. And then while they're in that condition, while the voodoo follower thinks that he is the horse who is carrying the psychic being on his back, they speak in tongues, they will prophesy, they'll give advice, and like so many other rather strange and dangerous religious groups, they will deliberately handle poisonous snakes, they'll endeavor to work spells, and, you know, there's other groups who they sometimes used to refer to as the holy rollers and the snake handlers and the shakers, some of these charismatic sects who do very similar things. And that's the basis of voodoo, that it's a combination of a traditional old Catholicism, which the African immigrants picked up when they came over to the West, with, you know, their own basic beliefs. The other big factor with the religion is the talismans that they use. Now, that comes from the Greek word, talein, and it carries the idea of being initiated into mysteries. Mm-hmm. So if you have a talisman, it means that you have been, you know, the little doll-like thing or something else. It doesn't have to be a solid physical object in every case. It can simply be a phrase or a religious saying that they've learned. One of them is the Vade Retro Satana, which means Satan, go back, which is a kind of defense against being possessed. And then they also have familiars that, you know, go along with witchcraft and voodoo, and often live animals, goats or snakes, toads, cats. And a talisman could even be a protective plant. Wolf's bane, which is aconitum vulperia, you know, also known as monk's hood or aconite. And the buttercup of the Ranunculaceae family was another talisman. So that's it in a nutshell. And what they claim to be able to do, of course, is practically limitless. They have healing spells. They have what they would also refer to as a hex, which is a bad spell that they'd put on you.
What do you think of these curses? Do you think curses actually work, Lionel?
No, what I think myself is that the powers in the human mind are so much greater than any of us have fully understood or experimented with that the link between the mind and the body is extremely strong. And when we take that same power of the mind and apply it to the external universe, I mean, if we think, for example, of an Olympic athlete winning his or her gold medal, it's 90% mental power that drives the physical body. They're amazing characters with wonderful personalities, and they seem to have, if we go through the gold medalists of history, they seem to be men and women who have this amazing willpower and the ability to control the body. There's also the outside influence. So I think that when somebody has allegedly put a curse on somebody else, it's the power in the, so we just call him a black magician if he wants to curse somebody, it's the power in the mind. And unless you're prepared to be afraid of him or her and to go along with it, then it can't affect you. The great thing to do is to say, with the quote from the old famous old proverb, I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my destiny. And you won't let anybody else break through and damage you with a curse. Now, somebody who believes in it will think, oh, I've been cursed. I'm in terrible trouble. and what they would then do is to tend to, I've had people who've come to me on occasion when they felt they needed a priest, and then they've come to me to say, Father, I believe I've been cursed, and I then perform an exorcism for them, or if they believe they've been possessed by some evil force, and I use holy water and a crucifix and an open Bible and go through the words of the exorcism and bless them, and usually they say, oh, I feel better now. Now, what I think is that rather than it being some strange external force, they have believed some evil things that a black magician has said to them or has sent them, and they then feel they have to come to a priest or a holy man of any religion who can help and bless them. But it's my fundamental answer would be that it's 99.9% in the mind. It's in the mind of the recipient, the would-be victim, the potential victim. And it's also in the mind of the magician who is attempting to put a curse on something.
So in order for a curse to work, does the person who's getting it, the recipient, does he have to, one, know about it, or two, believe in it?
Well, I would have said yes to both of those, that I don't think there is any external force that a magician can send out that would work. If you can terrify the victim, if the black magician can say, I have put a curse on you. Let me tell you a little story about this. So something that happened to me. We were doing a BBC documentary program over in Barbados, in the Chase Elliott tomb, you know, the famous one where the coffins moved around. Every time they buried a member of the Chase Elliott family, the previous coffins, these were big lead coffins weighing about a ton each. The previous interments had moved. And when I was over there doing this documentary, my producer, director friend back in the UK had said, Lionel, if you can, get hold of a local Obeah man or voodoo practitioner and ask him what he thinks. And I'd managed with some difficulty to track one of these guys down in Barbados, and I'd got him down in the tomb with me. And shortly before before he'd come in so I could talk to him, I had picked up a small piece of stone from the floor of the vault and shoved it in the pocket of my jeans to bring home as a souvenir. And of all amazing things, this guy says, once upon a time, a visitor from your country came here, and he picked up a stone from the floor and took it back to England with him. He had previously been wealthy and in a good job and in a happy marriage. He said, and as soon as he picked up that stone, things began to go wrong for him. His loving wife of 20 years left him. He lost his good job. All his stocks and shares collapsed, so he was pretty well penniless and lost his loving relationship. And then, he went on, said, he realized it was the curse on the stone of the Chase Elliott vault. So he sent it back to me, begging me to replace it, and I did. I heard from him a few days later. He had an even better job. His loving wife had returned, and he had made a huge killing on the stock exchange. He'd got his wealth, his occupation, and his woman back again. And he said that it was all because of the curse in the stone. I was killing myself laughing because I'd got one in my pocket. Now, this was nearly 20 years ago, and it's sitting within 2 yards of me now in my china cabinet.
Great with a little life.
Because had I, on the other hand, allowed myself to listen to this wonderful tale that he was telling me, you know, heaven knows what might have happened, but it would have been what I had done to myself by believing what he was telling me, rather than any power in the stone of the Barbados vault.
One of your other great books, The World's Most Mysterious Places, you looked at the possibility of Atlantis, didn't you?
Oh, yes. Now, this has never ceased to fascinate me. And the more and more our modern archaeologists learn, and there have been some tremendous expeditions to Peru, for example, where ancient civilizations have been found to have an architectural technology and ability, which you would also find in the ancient parts of Africa and the ancient parts of, shall we say, the Egyptian pyramids, so that the Babylonian pyramids, so that all around the world we have evidence of a technology. When you think of the Great Pyramid and the millions of tons of weight and pressure, and the way that those early Egyptian architects were able to build that would be a challenge, even with all our machinery and earth-moving technology, to the best of our construction engineers today. And where did it come from? I believe that there was a great civilization in Lemuria. I believe there was another one. I think the evidence, that's how I believe, I think that the evidence makes a reasonable case for some highly technological ancient civilizations to have been and gone, and that the survivors of those civilizations, if they escaped from whatever disaster overtook them, would have been able to take their technology. Let's just imagine, in a dramatic sense, that you and I and half a dozen other survivors had reached a new country after the collapse of the civilizations that are in our world here in 2014. And very few of us would be able to reconstruct. I mean, if we were, shall we say, in the middle of a desert or a wilderness area, there's nothing there. We can't even smelt iron or copper out of the rocks, never mind make metal sheets to create a car or a bicycle or any of the even elementary technology that we take for granted and use every day. We would know about it, but we wouldn't have the supporting equipment or raw materials to make it. So we would get together to pool such knowledge as we had, and we would then begin again, keeping that, shall we say, almost like a sacred book, a collection of our knowledge. And the time would come when things that we had and lost in the collapse of contemporary civilization, they would gradually come again. And we suppose that some of our survivors had gone north, south, east, west, and within a few centuries, reproductions of what we had once had and enjoyed would slowly come back. Now, when we think about the architectural skills and the civil engineering skills and the structural ability that pops up in so many different places, and a thing I would love to be involved with would be an expedition to Antarctica to get down under that ice.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And see what's there, because you know the theory is that maybe Atlantis shifted, mm-hmm. and that if we could just get down there, we would find all sorts of miracles. Yes, I certainly think that ancient civilizations existed, and I think that remnants and traces of them exist in the mysterious powers that built the Egyptian pyramids and the strange, but like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Where did they get the ideas for that? Did that come from an older and far more technical civilization that had agricultural techniques far in advance of anything in the Babylonian area?
Did you do any work on the aquatic monster Ogopogo?
Yes, I have written on him, and I've been over there and seen the his alleged habitat, and
he's over here in North America, right?
Yes. Yeah, yes, well, I think that the whole idea, now that we are getting, if we can just link that with some of the discoveries that are being made now at incredible depths, as our diving abilities, as our technological abilities to create ships and, submarines and devices that will go down to enormous depths and take photographs. Look at some of the more recent discoveries that have been made at depths where it seemed impossible that anything could live. But there are these guys swimming about. I saw some on television recently, things like lobsters, but 10, 15 feet long, and with shells and internal pressures that would withstand those depths. So I see no reason at all why the Ogopogo shouldn't have been very real, and maybe he's still about. We had, when the first sightings were made, we had two singing comedians. One was called Leslie Holmes, and the other was called Leslie Cerrone. And with your copious archives and research facilities, you might even be able to find this, because it was extremely funny. And the song was called I'm Looking for the Ogopogo. And the verse went, his mother was a crocodile, his father was a whale, and I'm going to put a little bit of salt on his tail. I'm looking for the Ogopogo. And or the next verse was, has anybody seen it? But it would be amazingly funny if you could actually find Leslie Cerrone and Leslie Holmes. They're called the Two Leslies, and they used to make old 78 records way back in the 30s. And as a young kid, because I was born in 1935, and as a young kid, I used to love their music. And my mum, as a young woman, worked in a record shop and would bring home, a 78 every now and again. It was like my pocket money. If I was a lucky boy, I got a new comic record every week.
Those were fun days, weren't they?
Sorry?
They were fun days, Lionel.
They were great fun days, yeah. Another one that I love, and I was able to get a DVD, a CD of him, was Frank Crummett. He was the guy who recorded what is still my favorite song about Abdullah Bulbul Amir and Ivan Skavinsky Skavar.
I remember that one.
Remember that one, yeah?
Hold on, Lionel. We're at the break. We'll come back with more in a moment. 8 feet under on our next Coast to Coast program. Michael Carter joins me as we talk about alien scriptures. Fascinating subject there. We're going to come back in a moment with Lionel Fanthorpe and take his final stories on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, final segment with Lionel Fanthorpe, whose website is linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com, the prolific writer indeed. You still on motorcycles these days?
No, I haven't been on a bike for a little while, but yeah, I'll tell you why. I used to love my great big Harley Davidson, and the greatest bike in the world. I made so many television shows on her, and I still ride as well as I did at 16, or as badly as I did at 16.
Yeah, exactly.
But, it was superb bike. I love Harley Davidson. And the problem was, I don't know quite how the tax system works in the USA, but I'm sure it's similar to ours. And when you're in business on your own, like I am, you have to pay your tax twice a year. And we'd had a particularly good year, and I didn't realize how much they were going to ask for. And as I couldn't manage without the car, I had to sell the bike to pay the tax for that year. So
wow.
I'm waiting for my next TV series, and I'm buying another Harley.
So they withhold here in this country. Don't they do that there?
What they do, if you run your own business and you need a good chartered accountant, as we call them, professional accountants, and you just send all your income and all your expenditure to your chartered accountant, he works out for you what your taxable profit is on your year's work. And then they send you from the central taxing authority via the accountant who's looking after you that they want, several hundred or several thousand pounds in. They've got to have it by the end of January for the first installment, and then they've got to have the rest in July. And as I said, I didn't realize quite how good a year I had had. And when the demand came in, it was something had to go. And so very reluctantly, we sold the bike, which is, they hold their value, which is a good thing. Otherwise, they couldn't have done it.
Yeah, they sure do.
But that's high on my list to get another Harley when the as soon as I get another big series. What bought me the first one was that big series I did on the Discovery Channel about the one called Castles of Horror.
Yeah.
And we ran 20 of those, and I was getting, very well paid for each episode. And that was what bought the bike in the first place. And I need another big series like that. So any producer directors listening, please, I'm still as good as I was 20 years ago. I just need the work. But I just clocked up, my birthday's on February the 9th, and I just clocked up 79, so I can technically say I'm in my 80th year, and I still feel 20. Yeah, and I still feel 25, so what the heck.
Do you celebrate St. Paddy's Day out there?
Yes, we do. Oh, indeed, yes. It's very important over here, and of course he was a truly wonderful man who did so much good. And we love Ireland and all things Irish, so St. Patrick is a great favorite of mine.
Tell me about the bookshop in San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, the haunted bookshop.
The haunted bookstore, yeah.
Yeah, now, one of the amazing things, when we went down to do the documentary on that one, and an amazing place, because very honest, straightforward, guys like us who worked in the bookshop, perfectly normal, rational folk, would come in the morning, first member of staff in, would unlock the shop, which had been, locked all the closing hours during the night, and one bookcase in particular was the scene of this. Well, it was almost like poltergeist activity. Books would be taken out of the places where they had been very carefully and neatly arranged by the staff and be all over the place. Sometimes the entire bookcase had been pulled over, but there was no damage. It was as if some slow-moving power had shifted it. And nobody had any explanation as to what it might have been. And, you've almost got these sort of cartoon ideas of something from the spirit world trying to find a particular volume.
Yes.
But it was always in that one place. And we investigated, as one does on cases like that, to see what had been in the area there before the bookshop became a bookshop, but there was nothing that could have accounted for it. Unlike a place here in Wales, where it was the history of the building that seemed to have caused the problems. The place in Wales is only about 40 miles from where we live in Cardiff, and is called the Skirrid, S-K-I-R-R-I-D, the Skirrid Inn. And the phenomena there seemed to have been traceable to, during the Middle Ages, it had been the local courtroom, and it was the place where, when a capital offence had been committed, the criminals were hanged there, and the rope from the ceiling was still in place as a sort of tourist attraction, that place had once been an execution site. Now, there was one room there, and I went with a television group to make a film about it, and there was one room in this Skirrid Inn where the prisoners had spent their last few hours on earth while the executioner and the courtroom officials were drinking it up in the bar and having a high old time before hanging the criminal. And in this particular room where the criminals had been spending their last hours, there was another haunted, allegedly haunted room. Patricia and I were sleeping in a great big four-poster bed in this allegedly haunted room. We saw and heard nothing. But the director and producer and camera crew had gone at night into the room where the criminals had spent their last hours. Uh-huh. And I suddenly get a knock on our door, and a frightened voice says, "Lionel, can you come at once and exorcise this place? We're terrified. Something's happening in here." So I slung a dressing gown on and went down and, pronounced a blessing, sprinkled some holy water and did the normal exorcism procedures. And they had a professional medium with them. It was a very sensitive and receptive bloke. He was a very good medium. And he said with a great sigh of relief, "Whatever it was is gone. Thank you, Father. You've done it. You've done it. You've got rid of it."
Wow. But he could feel that, huh?
Yeah, he felt it that much. And I, as I said, I'm like you, a scientific investigator, and I rarely, if ever, feel anything. I need a medium with me to tell me what's going on. And but you see, in the haunted bookshop, there was nothing like that same historical connection with people who had spent their last few terrified hours when you were asking about the bookshop, it made me think of a mystery that I've got in mind to investigate next, to see whether I can decode it. And that's, I don't think you and I have ever done it before, just
no.
The Voynich manuscript. Have you ever come across it?
I have not.
Well, the Voynich manuscript is an illustrated codex, and the system of writing within it is totally unknown. And it's in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Yale University at the moment. So it may be possible that if you like the story, you could get one of the experts from it. I think it's called the Beinecker Rare Book and Manuscript Library, part of Yale University. And they've got this thing. It's been radiocarbon dated to somewhere between 1404 and 1438. And it's believed by the experts that it was made in northern Italy, maybe during the Italian Renaissance. And it's named after a guy called Wolf Voynich. That's V-O-Y-N-I-C-H. He was a Polish book dealer, and he got hold of it way back in 1912, just over 100 years ago. And the pages of the codex are made of vellum, and there's about 250 of them. The writing is quite normal from left to right, but it's been worked on by so many professional and amateur cryptographers all across the USA, and we've had British code breakers who were from, the government code breaking agencies from World War I and World War II. But nobody has ever deciphered the text. And so it's the most peculiar mystery, I would say, in the history of cryptography. And I'd love to get, you know, copies of it, you know, the photocopies of it,
yeah.
And see if I could have a go at it, because it's several people have had a go but haven't been able to crack it. The language is unknown, and whoever did the illuminations run, and all that we know, that it was eventually donated by Hans Krauss to the Yale University Rare Book and Manuscript Library. It's been in Yale since 1969, where it's catalogued under MS-408. And you can also get the digitised high-resolution copy for free on their website. Now, I'm just wondering, when we think of all the listeners that we've got on Coast to Coast, one of them, surely, must have that kind of brilliant mind which could crack the Voynich manuscript. And hey, what a story that would be.
Oh, great story. Great story. What is so important and fascinating about Rennes Le Chateau?
Yeah. Well, the Rennes mystery, which is the one I'm writing up again for that Vatican Vaults book that I'm working on as one of the contributing authors, is that way back in 1885, a young and very interesting French priest named Béranger Saunière became the priest of the village church at Rennes-le-Château. And he was on a tiny stipend, which would have been the equivalent of about $10 for a year. So if you've got to feed yourself on less than a dollar a month, you're unlikely to get fat, even in 1885. So Béranger Saunière, who was very popular with his parishioners, would arrange his pastoral calls so that if he called, imagine that we'd been two of the villages, he'd call on you at breakfast time, me at lunchtime, and our friend Tom for supper, so that he managed to call on his pastoral visits when there was food on the table, so otherwise he would have starved. But he was that poor. And then in sometime before 1891, he made a discovery. Nobody knows what it was, but he made a discovery which made him the richest man in the south of France. And this is in the area known as the Languedoc in southwestern France, which is where Carcassonne, the ancient city, with all its history, is. Now, when he had made his money, his church had been partly ruined. There were holes in the roof and birds flew in and out of the windows. He restored the church, and we know how expensive it is to do any restoration work, even as long ago as that. He spent a fortune on pictures for the church, on statues for the church. He made it absolutely beautiful. And then, suppose that, as I said, if we had been his village parishioners and had given him a glass of goat's milk and a bit of bread and cheese when he was hungry, he then invited us. He built himself a luxury villa called the Villa Bethania and invited his friends from the village who had helped him when he was so poor, invited us back for six-course meals with wine in every course. Now, there was also, and he was a bit of a lad, he wasn't very priestly in the traditional sense. When he was in his early 40s, he took unto himself a very, very attractive village lady called Marie de Narnaud, who was ostensibly his housekeeper, but was actually his mistress. And he also, there was, in France at that time, an extremely expensive opera singer and courtesan, shall we say politely, by the name of Emma Calvet. And if you could afford to take Emma Calvet out, you were rich indeed. She was a millionaire's courtesan. And Saunière had an association with her. So we had young Marie at home when he got back from his extensive fun trips. And he had one of his adventures with Emma Calvet, the opera singer. So he spent money like water, and He built orangeries. He built himself a watchtower. And that was an amazing place with a steel door. There was something that he was guarding very carefully. And when he died in 1917, ostensibly of cirrhosis of the liver, because he'd been a heavy drinker, being a good Frenchman who enjoyed his wine, he was thought to have been poisoned.
Who would have done him in?
Well, one of the many theories regarding the source of his mysterious wealth was that the Austro-Hungarian Empire, prior to the 1418 war, was a very powerful political influence in Europe. And Sonier had a bank account with the Austro-Hungarian Bank. It was as if some members, and they were connected to the Habsburgs, who were famous. It may have been that they had been paying him off for something that he'd given them. And towards the end of his life, there was another mystery. It looks as if, well, we jump on to the post-Second World War, and some archaeologists who were digging in what had once been the church lawn came across the bodies of three young men, each of whom had been shot, and then buried in the lawn. And one of the theories is that these three were secret agents working for Austria-Hungary, it was just alleged, who had been sent to kill Sonier. And they had mistakenly assumed that a village priest would be a very soft, easy target. And of course, he was anything but a traditional village priest. He was tough and ruthless. And I can imagine him in bed with Marie with his six-chambered revolver under the pillow just in case. And he sees these figures going past and he gets his arm out from under his lady and says, "Marie, go and get the spade. I'm just going outside for a minute." And it's bang, 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 and there are three bodies on the lawn, and Marie turns up with the spade, and they go down about 2 feet deep and were found again by archaeologists long after Sonia's time. But one of the thoughts is that he had discovered some enormously powerful religious artifact. Another thought is that he had uncovered some ancient secret. It's tied in with a group who were called, if they really exist, and they're very shadowy, the Priory of Zion, who may still be around. And they were connected, according to legend, with the Templars. The Templars were their military arm, but they were very mysterious sort of guides and guardians. They may even have been the boys who wrote the Voynich manuscript, which is why I'd love to decode it.
Lionel, you keep in touch with us again, my friend. Lionel Fanthorpe. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Alex Lonehood, Sean Lottasour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.